Good morning. Go ahead and have a seat, everyone. And welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals for our oral argument calendar. Today is July 27th, 2022, and we're just so glad to be back and actually seeing people in the courtroom. It seems strange when we don't have all of our files because of the electronics, but it's nice to be back and to see some familiar faces. I'm going to call the first case for hearing. Amy Murphy as appellant versus Valley Fair LLC respondent. Attorneys, you've been here before. When you're ready to proceed, indicate who you are and which party you're speaking on behalf of. When you're ready, as far as appellant counsel, you may proceed.
Good morning. My name is Chuck Slane, and I'm here representing appellant Amy Murphy. Today we are asking this court to reverse the district court's denial of our motion for a new trial and to remand for that new trial. We all agree that a duty of the district court is to reconcile a verdict in any way possible. However, there are three requirements that the court is required to follow. One, the reconciliation must be based on evidence on the record. Two, the district court should harmonize all of the findings of the jurors in the verdict. And three, when there is a finding of negligence but no causation, you can reconcile that verdict only if there's evidence of some other cause to support the jury's finding. So when a jury
finds—
But
that other cause, counsel, wouldn't necessarily be an act of negligence by some other third party.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear.
The other cause wouldn't necessarily be an act of negligence by another third party.
Not necessarily. There can be many other sources of other causes, but the search that the district court has to do is to find evidence on the record of another cause other than what is available to the jurors in their verdict.
When isn't your best argument that that's exactly what the parties were doing in the case? Because they were pointing at each other and at nothing else?
They were pointing at each other and nothing else. There was no evidence of any superseding cause. There was no instruction given on superseding cause because the record did not reflect it. There were no arguments made that there was any cause other than the actions of the two parties in this case. That is the state of the record. And when a jury finds negligence but no cause, there simply must be something on the record to support the finding that something else is the cause.
So, counsel, why isn't it that, you know, according to the record, that your client tripped while she was, you know, there's some evidence kind of moving quickly to catch with a drink in her hand, right, to catch up with her husband and son, you know, and the district court does refer to that, you know, in its written memorandum. So why, you know, and you can do that without being negligent. You know, she didn't even necessarily right to have to trip on that particular, you know, raised area. Why isn't that enough?
Because the jury found that was negligence. And
how are we on that's the negligence?
Well, because there's no other theory to support negligence here. The theory is either that she is not paying attention or she's going too quickly. There's no other evidence or other theory presented here. And the jury says, yeah, that's unreasonable. You should look where you're walking. How can that not be a cause of her falling down?
But why couldn't it be that it's like the jury, I mean, because we don't know what they thought. Well, maybe they thought her negligence was going too fast, but not tripping, or tripping, but not going to, you know, it could be one or the other, right?
And either way, it would be a cause. How could we possibly say that either of those things, if that was her negligence, didn't cause her to fall under the evidence on this record?
The case that gives me trouble is just this recent, you know, the Myrtle Lake Resort case where the Supreme Court says, well, you know, sometimes people can trip and fall or fall downstairs, I think was that case, right?
That's, you know, the Staub case.
Right. Sorry, I was referred to by the other party's name. You know, without any negligence whatsoever, why, to me, you know, maybe that's what's happening here.
It's not, and I'll explain to you why. And I think the Minnesota Association for Justice got it right. This whole discussion of bad luck kind of is interesting, because what the district court did is it used bad luck as an alternative to causation, but it's not. It's an alternative to negligence. And that's why the jury has to decide, is this just an accident, bad luck, or was someone negligent?
But we don't know if the jury thought that, but for each of them contributing the perfect storm, that this would not have happened. So how do we impute what you're asking us to the jury verdict? I mean, we don't know what they were thinking.
Well, the reason that we don't know what they were thinking is because when that verdict came in and I objected to it, and I said, this is not reconcilable, send them back. We would know the answer had the judge done that. But instead, the judge accepted this verdict knowing the problems. And then unfortunately, when he goes through his process and substitutes bad luck for causation instead of negligence, he put in his judgment as to what the jury should have done. And in essence, took away our right to have the jury decide these factual issues. And that's why it was important that at that point, I made that objection. I said, no, don't accept this verdict. Let's find out what the jury means by what they're saying, because this doesn't make sense. It's not supported by the evidence. And that's how we know what to do here. But in looking at the case law in Minnesota, it's very clear what the state of Minnesota has decided on these types of claims. And that is, there has to be some other evidence of another cause. Lowe said it specifically. It's an unpublished decision, but it said straight on, if there is not evidence of an alternative cause, it's not reconcilable. Lowe cited Weber, in which a child ran out in front of a car, and the question was, is this just an accident because the child darted out, or was that driver negligent? And the jury says, negligent, but they found no causation. And the jury says, there is no other cause. So we can't reconcile that verdict, and a new trial was granted. Clifford, we know that the decedent took the medication that was prescribed, and either the pharmacy got it wrong or the doctor got it wrong. And the jury finds negligence but no causation. It's like there's no other cause.
Counsel, maybe you could help me with Clifford, because I just see that case as being very different. I mean, people aren't poisoned, just with, I think, wasn't it lithium there? I mean, which is, obviously tragic. You know, is it someone is necessarily at fault? Is it the pharmacist? Is it the doctor? Is it the nurse? Whereas, and that gets me back to my the Staub Myrtle Resort case, but sometimes people do trip and fall down without negligence. So isn't that just a different situation?
The reason that it's not different is because, like Clifford in this case, the jury found that's not what happened. The jury found negligence, and as Clifford tells us at page 688, the finding of negligence is a rejection of the theory of it's just an accident and things just happened. So we know that if we harmonize the findings on this verdict, that's not what happened.
What were the facts on Myrtle Beach again?
The facts in which case?
The Myrtle Beach Resort case.
It was an employee at a resort who was traversing an old cement staircase, and there were no witnesses, and she ended up at the bottom of the staircase.
Correct. I was on that case, and there was no jury verdict in that case. So
no,
that
was
talking about reconciliation.
That's correct, because that was a summary judgment issue, and whether or not the jury should be allowed, if not required, to decide on this issue of causation, make that factual finding. And here, that's the problem with this verdict, is we didn't get a factual finding from this jury. Instead, the trial court gave us its judgment as to what it should be. And that's where things went wrong.
There was no finding of negligence, though, in Myrtle Beach, because she had died. So there was no way to know what she tripped over.
There was no way to know, because she wasn't there to tell us. Whereas in this case, the facts were numerous people had fallen on this curb. And in fact, the 3002 witness from Valley Fair admitted that this curb was the cause of people falling. They knew it was a problem. It had happened many times before, and they had chosen not to take action to fix it. And so the state of the record in this case is Valley Fair admitted this curb was causing people to fall. The other thing I wanted to address was the need to look at all of the jury's findings rather than picking and choosing which ones to look at. The district court undertook to say, well, why do I have to go further? Once they said Valley Fair's fault was not a cause, I can stop right there. And that's tempting in the name of efficiency, but wrong. Think about when you reconcile your checkbook. Can you pick and choose which transactions to include to balance it out? Or do you have to look at everything? But really, the best example of why it's wrong is to look at what the trial court said in this case. It said, I can justify the finding of no causation because the jury, maybe they found plaintiff's negligence was the cause. I know, right? Because the jury specifically said it wasn't. And that's the best illustration I can think of as to why you got to look at all the findings, not just pick and choose which one is convenient for you. Take it a step further. What if the jury had found causation on both, but then put down each of them is 100% responsible? Would I be able to come into court and justify that verdict by saying we can stop by saying Valley Fair is 100% responsible? Or would the court also have to say, yeah, but they also found your client 100% responsible?
Yeah,
we got to look at all.
The instruction does say the total must equal 100%, so that would be a mathematical error. It wouldn't work. I mean, your example that they both came back at question five and said 100%, 100%, that doesn't equal 100%. So, you know, that's a little easier to
work. It is. And that's why I think if we just look at what the district court did in this case, it doesn't work. Because they're justifying it saying, well, maybe the jury said plaintiff's fault was a cause when they said it wasn't. So we have to look at all of the findings and see if we can harmonize them together.
Where did this word substantial come into our jurisprudence as opposed to direct?
That's a really good question, and I don't have the answer to it.
Because that seems to be the problem here. I don't think tort law requires substantial. I think it requires direct.
Because I think the word substantial is what led to confusion with the jurors. And the reason why the word substantial is really problematic is it means different things to lawyers and lay people. Lay people will tell you substantial means large. It's a big part of it. Whereas in law school, we're all taught, no, it just means it's a real part of what happened.
Counsel, just as an example on that, the first civil tort case I was involved a motor vehicle accident where there was a claim against the driver because he was impaired, and there was a claim against the county for negligent road design. The jury came back finding fault on both parties and finding the driver 90% or 95% responsible and the county 10. It seems if you have a standard like substantial, the jury would never get the county's fault. You know, it was a passenger, and the passenger's fault was zero, so that they were able to recover from the county and the tortfeasor. It seems that using the word substantial would eliminate that kind of a verdict.
It can if you look at the word substantial as large, and I think that's the confusion that we have in this case.
That seems to be what the trial court was doing here, isn't it?
It does seem that way, yes. And originally, the jury instruction that we had requested when they asked for clarification of substantial was not what was given. Originally, we asked the court to say, no, it has to be an essential ingredient. And the court rejected that and instead circled back, and everyone eventually agreed on this substantial word where it had to be, sufficient to cause the injury by itself, which is confusing.
But as I understand the record, but correct me if I'm wrong, but when the jury brought that question, I mean, you didn't object to the additional instruction the judge gave, right?
eventually, after he had already rejected what we had asked for, we had asked him to say that it was essential. In other words, that it's, if you think about the double play analogy, that double play doesn't happen without each one of those players' actions, but each one is not itself enough of a cause. The court rejected that, and then eventually we did get to the had to be sufficient to cause the injury by itself.
I know time is running short, but if I may ask a final question here. I'm struggling kind of with the disconnect between what you're asking us to do, which is say, basically, where there's a finding of negligence, there must also be a causation finding unless the evidence presents some other cause, okay? I think that's one. But that just seems at cross purposes with the case law that says, look, where the jury's found negligence without causation, we are disinclined, generally, to second-guess that verdict. Mm-hmm. So if it's okay, Presiding Judge.
Yes, go ahead.
Could you help me with that central concern?
I will, and thank you very much for asking me that question, because it gets back to our three requirements. As long as the reconciliation is based on evidence of the record, we want the court to search long and hard for some justification so that that trial is done. But based on the state of this record, there is no other cause. So it gets back to our holding from the Supreme Court in Reese versus Henke that when the record is in this state, it is our duty to find as a matter of law that the negligence was a cause when there is no evidence of any other cause. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Slane.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Jeff Markowitz. I represent the respondent, Valley Fair. There is no conflict in this verdict, and even if there were, it may be reconciled on a variety of theories, including the following. Ms. Murphy presented to the jury a theory of negligence. That theory of negligence was that Valley Fair negligently failed to warn her about the partial curb, and that that's why she tripped, and that that's why she's injured. But when Ms. Murphy was asked by her attorney on direct examination, do you know what you tripped on? And this is page 159 of the transcript and 9 of respondent's addendum. Do you know what you tripped on? She replied, no. In response, her attorney then, I would say, rehabilitated or led her in the right direction to finally say, well, after the fact, I know in retrospect, essentially, that I tripped. Why? Because she looked at photographs taken by a friend while she was not there of the general area, and she's surmising that she tripped on the curb. The jury was not required to believe her. And rather, on review, with ordinary deference to the jury's verdict, we must presume, or at least it's the province of the jury, to reject that testimony as not credible. And if she did not trip on the curb, it's wholly irrelevant whether Valley Fair negligently failed to warn her about the curb. This is a Hauenstein situation. And this is essentially similar to how the Supreme Court resolved Hauenstein. Hauenstein was that product spillity liability case with the flying nozzle. But the flying nozzle issue only mattered for to whether the plaintiff was contributory negligent. The theory of negligence against defendant was that you failed to warn me about this product, this bottle. But Mr. Hauenstein testified that had he been warned, he would have done something differently, but the Supreme Court reasoned the jury didn't have to believe that. The jury could have rejected his testimony. And if the jury rejected his testimony, as we need to presume when giving the jury proper deference, then any failure to warn is wholly irrelevant. And that's the situation here. That's, I would say, the straightest path forward to resolving this case and affirming this discretionary decision.
But that's not the path the district court seemed to take. So, I mean, this district court seemed to kind of say, well, you know, some accidents can happen. Bad luck happens. It didn't say, well, they could have believed this part and not that part. Aren't we, bound to when we're giving deference to the district court and an abuse of discretion, should we be paying attention to what the district judge did, not kind of some other options?
Certainly, Your Honor, I mean, those matter, but this court is more than free, as it has said multiple times, to affirm on any grounds appearing in the record. And this one, I would say, jumps off the page. The jury is allowed to make credibility calls. Ms. Murphy said she didn't know what she tripped on, and the only evidence she presented to this jury about what she tripped on, that she tripped on the curb, was her surmising after the fact based on this photo taken by a friend. The jury didn't have to agree with her. And this is ordinary. Is there evidence in the record that supports the verdict? Was the verdict manifestly and palpably contrary to the evidence? It can't be. When this is the only record the jury had, and it did not have to accept it. That's the straightforward, I think the most straightforward path. Clifford is an unusual case, and I point the court's attention to George. George is where we get that statement about we don't second-guess juries' verdicts. And then in George, the Supreme Court drops footnote 6. And if you look at it, it's long. Hauenstein, which we rely on, is part of the general rule. There is one but see citation at the end of that long string cite, and that's Clifford. Clifford is the exception, not the rule, and it was extremely strange. Not this case. This is a trip and fall. We have Staub versus Myrtle Beach. And yes, it was at summary judgment, not at after a jury verdict. But I think it's still instructive. If you look at Staub, earlier in the opinion, it expressly endorses the view that juries are allowed to rely on, quote, life experience and common sense. This jury was provided that model instruction at transcript page 10 by the district court. You can rely on your experience and common sense. Ordinary lay jurors know how to sort through these ordinary cases of trips and falls. Ms. Murphy provided far from confident and stellar testimony on the issue, and the jury didn't have to agree with her.
But isn't that language in Staub and, you know, some of these other cases, which basically a high-level summarizing, so correct me where I'm wrong. Well, certain injuries like falls, falling down stairs, happen in the ordinary course without any negligence. So kind of you will say that in your briefs. But isn't that different? Because here the jury found negligence.
Yeah, and it's not similar. And the reason is the nature of the negligence theory. It's wholly severable from what happened. It was a negligent failure to warn theory. There could be negligence floating around right now. Someone could have misbuilt this building. This podium could have a defect. But it doesn't necessarily matter if it doesn't actually cause me any harm. That's the situation with this duty to warn. There can be entities can have negligent failures all over the place, but if they don't actually attach to a causal chain that hurts someone, the law doesn't make them liable.
Wasn't there evidence that a number of people had tripped on this curb?
And the question, though, isn't what happened to others. The question is what happened to Ms. Murphy.
Okay, and Ms. Murphy said when she went back and reconstructed it in her mind, she was convinced that she tripped on the curb, which is what the other people had said.
And what the jury heard.
Right. So there's evidence on the record that supports that theory. So and why not have the jury finish their job? And my reading of the case, counsel, is if your side had let them finish their job, they would have ruled in your favor anyway. But
two responses to that, Your Honor. One, it did finish its job. It made a decision. And second, the issue of whether the jury should have been returned to make a deliberation, that was raised in post-trial motions, but it was not raised on appeal. And related also to preservation, important is this jury instruction issue that's kind of crept in and evolved on substantial. That also was not preserved in the post-trial motion papers. It crept in and evolved over time. It's not in the motion. In the memorandum, counsel or Ms. Murphy actually argues that the substantial instruction helped her case, just not enough. If you look at, I think it's page 10 of the memorandum, the jury implied that it was going to find Ms. Murphy negligent and that it approximately caused the injury, and then it turned back. Then we have an oral argument for which we don't have the transcript, but the district court's order saying an oral argument, this jury confusion issue was raised apparently for the first time. That's not proper preservation. It's not properly on appeal. And even if it were, we have that Frazier v. BNSF decision cited in appellant's reply brief. That was this court's decision, which was reversed, and for good cause that is instructive here. And which is essentially that even if invited errors for jury instructions are reviewable, even if that the error is erroneous and plain and prejudicial, the administration of justice doesn't warrant a new trial in circumstances such as this one. You got the benefit of a trial on one theory, and now you're trying to say, well, that didn't work out, let me try another. And that's not fair. And even under the Supreme Court's BNSF decision, if this court was to apply plain error review, which is, I don't believe, ever been done by a Minnesota appellate court since Frazier, at least.
But I still come back to why is this word substantial in there, period? I think it's the wrong word. Because you have a lot of negligence cases where the issue of apportionment of fault is very close, and maybe the jury's going to come back 60-40 in favor of the plaintiff or 40-60 in favor of the defendant. With that word substantial, you could argue, you know, that at the stage you were at, the combination of both parties was substantial, but of either party wasn't in the jury's mind. That's the problem I have with this.
And it's an interesting question, but two responses. One, as to where does the word come from, it's developed into Minnesota law over some time. We cite a recent decision from the Minnesota Supreme Court on page 10 of our brief, section 3, which goes through the law on proximate cause. This is the Jepson decision, and it's been there for a long time. But to be fair, a defendant didn't want this instruction. Defendant wanted direct cause. Direct cause is the word that we typically use. Substantial is a word we use to
explain. But they wanted essential. I must have missed her.
I think it's direct cause. Our proposed jury instruction, our proposed special verdict form is in.
I'm talking about what Mr. Slane had said earlier about essential versus substantial. But never mind. It has nothing to do with your client.
That kind of gets to the ingredient of baking cookies. Supplement part.
Sure. And it's not what defendant wanted, but it's what plaintiff got. And this is what the heart of BNSF in the Frazier decision, the Supreme Court said, that's just not right. You don't get to urge something, see it not work out for you, and then turn around and say, well, I want to try something that is the polar opposite, particularly when you didn't preserve this error. That's been an evolving issue that has only really crystallized, I think, really in the reply brief, maybe the opening brief, but certainly not in the opening motion papers. And that's black letter law. This issue was not preserved in a post-trial motion, perhaps because, again, plaintiff wanted this in the first place. I think this is fair. I mean, this is, I think, Hauenstein is fair. It just makes sense to me. If you just strip it away, the jury was presented with questions about something that everyone's experienced. We've all tripped. We've all fallen. And this isn't lithium poisoning. This isn't something that doesn't occur in the ordinary case without negligence. Ms. Murphy argued it was negligence, but her theory was there's a way to read this record that is utterly divorced and separates the negligence theory from what actually happened. Ms. Murphy didn't know at the time that she had tripped on the curb. She didn't think it was true. And the jury heard that. The jury was allowed to hear her tone, hear the fact that her answer was a direct no. Do you know what you tripped on? And hear that she only then says she thinks she tripped on the curb after the fact when led by counsel. The jury is allowed to apply their common sense, weigh that, make credibility decisions. And I think this is a plain vanilla issue in which we're saying we defer to the juries. This is their province to hear that and sort it out. And that is one theory on which this verdict may be reconciled. Others outlined by the district court, which I think are certainly defensible and I could go into, but I think that's really this most straightforward one. And it makes this case really, really similar to Hauenstein. Both can be read as turning on credibility decisions. That's how the Supreme Court viewed the Hauenstein record. The jury didn't have to believe Mr. Hauenstein that the failure to warn had anything to do with his eye injury. And this jury didn't have to believe Ms. Murphy when she says, I infer after the fact that I tripped on the curb. It could have, perhaps, theoretically, but it didn't. It made this decision, and we have to view the verdict and the evidence light most favorable to the verdict.
But she's saying she tripped over something, so if not the curb, what did she trip over?
Perhaps her own 2 feet.
That's not what she's saying, counsel.
No, it's not what she says.
I mean, I've unfortunately walked and tripped a number of times, and there have been a number of times when I didn't really realize what I tripped on, but I knew I tripped on something, and I went back and looked, and the concrete's up a little bit or whatever it might be. I mean, that's human nature.
Sure, and this isn't to question Ms. Murphy's sincerity, I'll say. Maybe she sincerely believed it after the fact. But this is whether the jury had to find that was enough to find that she met her burden to prove it is more likely than not that this fact is true, that she tripped on the partial curb. And the jury didn't have to believe that on this sort of
testimony. So it was just a coincidence that she tripped in the same area that a number of other people attending Valley Fair had complained about.
Ms. Murphy's
unusual coincidence, counsel?
I can't speak to that. I mean, it's like she. We also don't know when she developed that view. It's possible she was outright lying. I'm not saying that she necessarily was, but this is also a view she could have developed, perhaps based on a view that there were prior complaints about this area. I mean, the point is, these are the sort of, if we were on summary judgment, this would be a much difficult argument to hoe, and we're not on a summary judgment motion. We're viewing the evidence in reverse, in the light most favorable to this verdict. And to point to the Staub decision again, I mean, yes, that was on summary judgment, and the Supreme Court said, send this to a jury. Send to a jury, let them apply their life experience and common sense to find out if this trip and fall was caused by negligence. That's what happened here. It got sent to a jury. They looked to perhaps their own common experience that we've all tripped, we've all fallen, and sometimes it just happens. You trip on flat surface. I've tripped on flat surfaces where there's nothing. The jury could have said maybe that's too big of a coincidence and made a different finding, but it didn't.
But they found negligence on both parties. It seems like they've got to take the other step and do comparative fault in facts such as this. You may well have won on comparative fault.
If the law on proximate cause is to mean anything, if we really mean what we say, that parties have a burden to prove proximate cause, and that's not just but-for cause, but that's actually something above but-for causation. By the way, we don't even meet but-for cause if the jury didn't believe her that she tripped on the curb at all. But if we're going to say...
How do we reconcile the verdict when the parties are both, pushing forward their theory, and the jury is saying that, yeah, both of them were negligent, but not telling us why one or the other should win?
Well, the jury wasn't asked what they think of maybe an alternative cause would be. They don't provide a rationale, but what they were...
There was no evidence of an alternative cause, was there? What was that? I mean, they found negligence on both parties.
So, I mean, the alternative cause could have been Miss Murphy rushing to catch up with her husband and son, and that fell short of proximate cause. This isn't just was there a little bit of interaction. This was proximate causation. But in any event, you don't need evidence to just say there was not an evidence to support Miss Murphy's theory. She bears the burden of proof. She must prove she tripped on a curb and that it happened proximately because of a negligent failure to warn. The jury's finding, simply stated, is that she did not meet her burden to prove that connection.
If that's the case, the jury then should have found she was the cause.
But it may have also then found that she.
Either.
It may have also then found that she was not the proximate cause. That defendant did not satisfy its burden of proof, and it said, "There's just not enough here from both of you. We're not sure what exactly happened here, but we do know we were told that both parties needed to prove it was more likely true than not true that the other's negligence caused Miss Murphy to fall. And we don't think either of you did that. We think you were both negligent, but we don't think you actually pushed the ball over the finish line for this critical element. That's a separate point."
But it seems like there's no other cause other than these two events, and the jury should get to the final decision, which is to compare the fault of the two.
I would suggest that if that were true, we need different model jury instructions. Juries need to be told that when there's competing negligence theories and there's no other evidence of another cause in the record, you are compelled, if you find negligence, to find that one of those party's negligence proximately caused the injury, which is just not the law. It's if you look at, again, Section 3 of our brief, we talk about the law governing proximate cause, and I'll close there if I may briefly conclude. A finding of negligence by itself would not establish liability without a further finding that such negligence was the proximate cause of the accident. This is Boutang, page 10 of our brief. There's no reason to say, well, when there's competing theories of negligence, that rule is different, that you need to pick one or the other. That would be a different rule and require different jury instructions and different Minnesota law.
And your time has run out.
It has. Thank you, Your Honors. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much for your remarks. Mr. Slane, you have the last word.
Counsel, Justices, thank you. I think the theory...
I have a question for you because I I'm going to have to go back and look at the record, but... You know, it occurred to me when Judge Kirk was raising his questions, we always think back to our own jury trials. Didn't or wouldn't you have explained the significance of the verdict? You always explain the verdict to the jury, what they're going to be doing. Did that not happen here?
Sure, it did.
Your closing remarks.
Yes. Both parties explained that to them. And I think the record is replete with information that there was, the confusion was this word substantial.
That's what I wanted to know, if that came up in your instructions, your argument to the jury as far as substantial.
Honestly, no one argued causation in this case because there was no dispute on causation in this case. It's not fair for Valley Fair to come here and pick and choose and twist these facts and say she didn't know what she fell on? Because the part that...
She said she didn't know.
She said she didn't know when she fell. Then she looked behind her and saw this curb that wasn't readily visible. And the part that they left out is then the security folks from Valley Fair come and they fill out an incident report that says, tripped on curb. That is an admission that that is what she fell on. So I just wanted to point that out. The other matter I wanted to clarify was the remarks regarding the Hornstein decision, the glue and the nozzle. That was not a credibility case. That was a case where there was evidence on the record of an intervening cause. Because the theory of negligent warning, the jury said, yes, you should have warned these people about it. But the nozzle came off the bottle and a big glob of glue went into your eye. That's beyond what you needed to be warned of. That is an intervening cause. And so there was evidence there to say, we can reconcile this because there's another alternative. The other case where there's an alternative, where it's reconciled, is George. In that case, the record is replete. There's testimony of hundreds of other accidents happening because of weather. There's state troopers talking about how bad the weather was when they're getting there. So the jury had evidence to support that even though this driver was negligent, the weather was so bad, we're just going to call it a weather-related crash in this one. But in this case, there's nothing. There is no other cause. And we have Valley Fair admitting that they knew this curb was tripping people. They're admitting that this curb tripped Miss Murphy. And had they simply let the jury finish their job, we wouldn't be here now. And you know, had they joined me in the request to send that jury back and finish deliberations, could be the jury would have found against Miss Murphy and found her to be the majority at fault. But the reason we don't know is because the judge didn't send them back. And the judge took away our right to know what the jury thought about these facts. And we ask that you remand this matter back and give us an opportunity to have a jury decide those facts. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you to both attorneys. I will say the matters were very well briefed and the arguments today are extremely helpful. A decision will be issued by this court within the statutory time frame. With that said, we are adjourned from this proceeding.